I want to review some comments I made 2 weeks ago on prayer, and I want to talk about the role of religion and what religion is supposed to accomplish on a societal level, but internally as well. And I'll use a model that comes from the Tanya, from the book by the founder of Chabad. But I want to begin with a story. I did tell it one other time, but probably only some of us were here. No dig was meant by that. But if you want to take it that way, I guess I am allowed to peddle a little bit of guilt. It was during my time living in New Mexico, and I cooked with this man, Paul. And Paul and I became friends, so that he invited me to go to his brother's wedding. I was honored. We'd only known each other a few months. And he said, I have to just give you a heads up. My brother has Down syndrome, and everyone at the wedding, there will be 50 or 60 people from his community, all of whom have Down syndrome. This was New Mexico. And I guess the age of destination weddings started some time back, because we hiked down into a national forest where the wedding was to be held. And we got through the forest and the pines and the aspens to an opening where the chuppah was. And there were 100 people there with Down syndrome. I'd met people with Down syndrome before, but I never encountered an entire community. And I don't ever want to raise up our differences that we have as either an advantage or disadvantage. Every human being gets given a certain deck of cards, and we all live out our lives as best we can. With that said, as a caveat, as I went down, there was this incredible sense of joy and love and this delicate energy exuding off of this community as one of their own got married, as one of their own who was a little bit higher functioning and who'd be able, they would be able to move into their own apartment and have a basic job but have a life of dignity. And that occasion to me still is the deepest experience I have ever had of unadulterated love. A sort of love that those of us who have different cognitive perspectives on the world don't always get to. And it left a permanent mark in my soul. Because if they could do it, maybe I could get there too. So 2 weeks ago, I talked about prayer, and I talked about how we are in between paradigms. We reviewed the ancient prayer system in the temple and how our ancestors would publicly bring these animals and imbue in these animals their own weaknesses and offer the animal up and know that as the animal was slaughtered, it was being killed because we messed up. And about what a tremendously powerful expression of religion that was for our ancestors. And I talked about how after that, of course, that era, the temple worship disappeared, and we moved religion and prayer from a place, something that happened in space with physical objects, with animals in the temple in one location in Jerusalem, into Avodah Shebalev, words of the heart that existed in time, and that for the next 2,000 years, our prayer life was based on our offerings of time. And it worked. But we know, because that laughter earlier means lots of us don't come regularly to service. And we have a wonderful cantor here who brings so much, and we hope that will attract you. But we're moving through this phase to something not yet clear, where we don't have time and we don't have space. And we talked about that, what that means in an era where everything is done electronically, and how we don't have any opening, ready opening, and how, therefore, the new form of prayer is going to have to be a new sort of internal process. And that brings me to the topic of holiness in our parsha and the role of religion. There's a debate in our tradition as to what's this holiness? I mean, it's a bizarre word, and in English, it's a really strange word. I bet none of you have ever turned to your friends at a cocktail party, even after three martinis, and said, you know, how's your holiness project going? Oh, wow, yeah, work's been busy. I put holiness on the back burner for a while. The term is alien to us. But once upon a time, our people debated it. And a great argument was held by Rashi, Shlomo Yitzhaki, the French winemaker, and Ramban Nachmanides, the great Sephardic. I can't even list his full criteria. He worked in many fields. Rashi says that being holy is just fulfilling the mitzvot that we just read. The mitzvot as they are in the Torah, if we do them, will be enough that we holy life. And if we look at them, don't stand on the blood of your neighbor, a bunch of other mitzvot, we don't do them anyway. And it would be an accomplishment if we got there at a very basic level as a society. But they remain mostly dead words in a living book because we don't bring them to life. Nachmanides must have been hanging out at a different cocktail party where people really did turn to one another and said, so how's your holiness work going? Because Ramban says that you, it is amazing, kadesh et hamutar, kadesh atzmecha et hamutar. You will sanctify even that which is permitted to you. You, in other words, will not only fulfill everything the Torah says, you'll do even more. That holiness is a way that we strive, as a child strives, to constantly develop. What an amazing concept. But we struggle with religion in our era. And so I want to offer what I think is the next sort of phase of where we need to be, but that we all struggle with. And it's been going on a couple hundred years, but the news sometimes travels slowly. And Baal HaTanya, the founder of Chabad, talks about holiness in relationship to different types of people. And you've heard these. You've heard them even for me on high holidays. We have three categories of people. We have tzaddikim, righteous people. We have Rasha'im, wicked people, and we have Benonim, the middle folk. And the Talmud has a take on it, but Baal HaTanya gives us a very beautiful and useful model. He says that tzaddik, and particularly that tzaddik gemor, the absolutely righteous person, when they look at the world, doesn't even have a desire for evil. So let me translate that into terms that we will recognize. That the animal side of ourselves, the biological machine as we like to talk about now, the libidinal impulses that control so many of us, the tzaddik has evolved so that those concerns are not in control, even on an unconscious level. Pretty cool. You won't find that person at the cocktail party because they probably won't be having that martini with you. The wicked person, in his understanding, is the person whose desires, whose animal nature, the machine aspect of ourselves that we hear about so much, has full control. And the perfectly wicked person, in other words, is someone who is only controlled by their desires and can't rise above them. Not only can't, have no interest. They're very happy acting out of their libidinous center, their pure id. So you'd assume then, of course, that the Benoni, the middle person, would be sort of us. And what he talks about is that for us, we're in a place where the middle person actually is not someone doing wrong, but who's trying most of the time, and most of the time does the right thing. And we've got a pretty great group of people here. I know a lot of you at this point. I know your lives, I don't know everything, but we've got great people in here. And so that definition offered is not inappropriate for a lot of us. And yet what he says is that the Benoni still has the desire to do evil. We still like our body to rule us. Think about when you enjoyed getting angry and feeling all that energy rise up in you and how powerful you felt. Think about the smell of that steak sizzling on the grill, or maybe a brisket, smoking, Texas style. We still want to do the wrong thing, and sometimes it's willpower, and sometimes it's social control and forces, because we worry about losing our job or losing our friends, losing respect, and that makes us do it. But the Baal HaTanya wrote an entire book because he argued that our goal ought to be to attempt to become the tzaddik. Let me put that in another way. That we ought to struggle to change ourselves inwardly so that we can get to a point where we don't need willpower, where we don't need social control or peer pressure, but where we've developed enough that some of those desires have been sloughed off, refined. That's not what we think about when we think about religion. And I have to tell you, the people who are not here today are not here because when they think about religion, apart from maybe boring or stodgy, they think of a bunch of rules and being told what to do and judgment and all sorts of old-time religion. That doesn't feel good to us. So they never even show up. And that sort of religion is imperiled. The people who still, the places where religion is strongest are those who somehow have kept that aspect of religion alive. Fundamentalism is doing well and good, but the center has hollowed out precisely because that old-time religion will not work for us, and we're not sure what we're supposed to do, and we're not sure if we are committed to actually trying to do that inner work. We're not sure if we believe it because society keeps telling us we're just biological animals. There's nothing more to us. The soul's an illusion. We don't want to do it because we don't particularly like discipline that requires something out of us, that requires us to look at ourselves so that the impulses that implode our own lives can be overcome and transformed. I wrote an article, which I imagine some of you read, about my own struggles with sarcasm. I do that for a reason. Yes, this is my own inner work, but I do that as an offering because we can change if we want to. It's not easy, and there are setbacks along the way, but we have the capacity. And that ultimately is the role of religion in a time when we don't have a space and we don't have time. It's the soul, that timeless, spaceless part of us, the part of ourselves that can look at itself in three dimensions, in real moments, watch itself and make corrections and develop. That, I think, is the goal. But it is a demanding goal, and we need role models for it. I can only take you so far, right? I guess a teacher only has to be a chapter ahead. So I shared my own struggle with sarcasm. But I keep thinking back to that woods in New Mexico. I keep thinking about those people for whom love was so natural that the inner dimensions of their lives weren't plagued by some of the things that we struggle with. And the Baal HaTanya, when he writes that, says that because he's met people in all three of those categories. You know, the great age of psychology is over. When people would go and sit on a couch and regress with Freud for many, many years, we're too fast-paced. And that's one of the real reasons I think that religion is also in trouble. There was a point in time where we used psychology in its place. But the needs of the soul are always there. We buried Jasmine Spiegel this week, 29 years old, and she did not want to go. This was not some Pollyannish vision that she was at peace. She was angry and disappointed, and she did not want to disappear. But she also, throughout her life, lived as fully and truly who she was. And when I say lived as fully and truly who she was, I don't mean our ids, which seems to be where we are in a society. If I say whatever comes out my mouth, that's me being me. No, that's your animal side. And our society needs religion more than ever. And we turn to a cantor to help create a space in our hearts, an opening in our emotions. We turn to music, because music holds emotions and calls them up better than anything and makes us feel. And it's when we unite our feelings and our mind that we can become a little bit better than who we are, that we can refrain from saying, boys are boys, just being boys, that we can let go of the excuses that allow us to stop striving. In an era where anything seems to go except for that search for greatness, this has to be our oasis of peace, where we will say, yes, I'll try to do a little bit better until eventually, please God, the parts of me that want to do wrong disappear and fade away. Shabbat Shalom.